only trying to acquit a guilty monster. I am also in on the conspiracy to kill you. Christ, can't you take anything I say to you at face value? The fact that you have at least two faces complicates the issue. He shook his head. You always took it too personally, he said almost to himself. The job is the job, Ellen. Just because we stand on opposite sides of the courtroom doesn't mean we can't set it aside when we walk out the door. Oh, that's rich, coming from you, Tony, she sneered. You're never off the job. As far as you're concerned, there are 24 billable hours to a day. No situation, no relationship is exempt. Don't even try to argue with me on that score, and don't delude yourself into thinking you can win me over. I know just what lengths you'll go to. Their past hung between them, dense with complicated facts and feelings and fears that had never been proved true or false. Be careful, Ellen, he said at last. While you're busy watching for me to strike, there's a real snake out there. And his name is probably already in your Rolodex. Your imagined accomplice? Technically, I believe I would be correct in calling him your accomplice. In your delusions of vengeance. He buttoned his jacket and tugged it straight, preparing himself for the cameras. Nice try, sicking the BCA after me, getting Wilhelm to make noise about a warrant for my phone records. Sadly, it's just another example of how this investigation is being botched, which is what I'll have to point out to the press. Point away, Tony, Ellen said with a knife-edge smile. All the press needs is a suspicion of your involvement, and they'll be digging like badgers. Who knows what they might turn up? I know I'll be standing right there to see what crawls out of your lair. She jerked the door open and stepped out into the hall, eager for once to upstage him in front of the cameras. I don't know how much help I can be to you, Mr. Brooks, Christopher Priest said without apology. His expression was as neutral as his voice, his face the blank oval of a mannequin's. His office was exactly what Jay had imagined, a claustrophobic little cube crowded with books and file cabinets. A computer monitor on the desk displayed an endless repetition of starbursts. The room was filled with the stuff of academia, textbooks and reference books and student papers, but with none of the personal bric-a-brac that would have given a flavor of the man whose name was on the small placard outside the door. The desk was too neat, the office as devoid of personality as the professor himself. Some of my students and I were involved with a volunteer effort to find Josh, he said, seating himself with prim precision. We set up computer stations at the volunteer center and went online to disperse and receive information through the various networks. That's the extent of my connection. Jay voiced his skepticism. That's a bit of an oversimplification, don't you think, Professor? You volunteered to help with the investigation, then one of the cops involved was attacked in your own front yard, then your best friend was arrested. You must be feeling like this whole thing is sucking you in like a tar pit. It's been a little overwhelming, yes, he conceded. And Dr. Garrison is a friend of yours, right? I know Hannah, he admitted. I admire her. She's an extraordinary woman. Jay took in the hint of color that touched the professor's pale cheeks when he spoke of Hannah. Man, if I had all that buzzing around me, I'd be feeling downright dizzy. Now the cops are looking for that student, Todd Childs, and looking at the sci-fi cowboys, you must feel almost as if you're under attack. Priest stared at him like an owl from behind his oversized glasses. I had nothing to do with any crime, neither did the cowboys. Circumstances suggest otherwise, where the boys are concerned. Circumstances aren't always what they seem. The sci-fi cowboys are a very select group of young men, Mr. Brooks, hand-picked for their talents and potential. Aren't most of their talents against the law? Academic talents, Priest specified, unamused. They are very bright young men who deserve a chance to prove they can be productive members of society. And they're no doubt grateful for the opportunity, Jay said. Giving a kid a gift like that inspires loyalty. Kids with the kind of backgrounds that cowboys have might express that loyalty in, shall we say, inappropriate ways. I stand behind the cowboys, Priest said flatly. I've said all I'm going to say about the subject to the police and to the press, and to you, Mr. Brooks. If you came here hoping for an admission of guilt, there's no point in continuing this conversation.
No, no, not at all.
I know what you told the police about the encounter with Tyrell and the other two boys Saturday night, he said,
in a strangely quiet voice, as if it were a lurid secret.
I simply told them what happened, Professor. I'm not taking sides.
Aren't you? His thin lips pressed together. You're not aligning yourself with Ms. North?
What would make you think I was?
The two of you had words at the benefit. You followed her out.
And he had been watching from his post beside Garrett Wright's wife. The idea stirred a strange sense of violation.
Ms. North has a philosophical objection to my work, Jay said, with a well-rehearsed sardonic smile. She has managed to equate the writing and publishing of true crime with the Romans selling tickets to watch Christians being devoured by lions.
Priest considered the response.
An interesting correlation. The readers of your work are, of course, insulated from the immediate horror of the violence, but perhaps the two do share a common attraction.
Not for me.
Well, it's all in our perception, isn't it? He said. And perception is dependent upon what? You can present the same set of facts and circumstances to five different people, and they may give you five different interpretations, which is why many seasoned courtroom attorneys will tell you there is nothing so unreliable as an eyewitness. The opinions we form are based on individual perceptions, something science has yet to fully understand.
Fascinating, isn't it? He gave his head a slight shake, as if humans were simply too much trouble, and cast an affectionate glance at his computer screen.
The human mind can be infinitely logical and pragmatic, or stubbornly irrational. A hopelessly vacant mind can hold a kernel of brilliance. A brilliant mind can be fatally flawed.
Which, would you say, applies to our kidnapper? A slight smile touched the corners of his mouth.
I wouldn't say. Human behavior is Dr. Wright's specialty, not mine.
But you were working on a project together, right?
We are working on a joint project dealing with, as it happens, learning and perception.
You've known each other a long time, you and Dr. Wright.
We both taught at Penn State.
Yeah, but y'all knew each other before that, didn't you?
I don't know what you're talking about,
Priest said guardedly. Jay feigned innocence.
Well, gee, you know, I was just doing a little digging, background work and all, talking to an old colleague of yours from Penn State who mentioned you all grew up in the same town.
I grew up in Chicago.
Huh. Well, you know, I'd read that, he said, scratching his head. Strange thing for a friend to be wrong about, wouldn't you say?
Nevertheless, Priest said impatiently, I might have visited Indiana as a boy, but I didn't grow up there.
So you didn't know Dr. Wright?
We became friends at Penn State.
Good friends. The kind of friends who share things, stick up for each other, help each other out.
Is there a point to this line of questioning, Mr. Brooks?
Jay gave a shrug and a smile.
I'm just trolling, Professor. Looking for background. I never know what I might find or where it might lead me. For instance, you might just up and say you'd do anything for Garrett Wright. Who knows where an answer like that might lead?
To a dead end, Priest rose. I'm sorry to cut this short, but I have a class to prepare for, Mr. Brooks.
Jay checked his watch. According to the helpful young lady in the main office, Christopher Priest didn't have another class until evening.
I guess I'll just have to check that background the hard way, he said, pushing himself to his feet.
Thank you for your time, Professor. He turned back at the door, catching Priest staring at him with that blank face.
That student who was in the car accident the night Josh was abducted, was he working on that joint project with you and Dr. Wright?
Yes, he was.
Hmm. I wonder what his perception of that coincidence would be.
I'm afraid we'll never know, Priest said. I received word this morning he passed away.
Jay sensed the news hit him harder than it had the professor. Death. Delivered off the cuff as an afterthought, with no more remorse than was socially required. He stepped into the hall, his head buzzing. The car accident had set everything in motion. Now the student who had been running an errand for Priest was dead. Todd Childs was a student of Wright's and Priest's. Ole Swain, the prime suspect, until his jailhouse suicide, had audited classes of both men. Megan O'Malley had suspected Priest. She had been attacked in the yard of Priest's secluded country home. Christopher Priest seemed as much a part of the story as Garrett Wright, and yet no one had anything on him. He was as clean as Teflon, visible in his efforts first to help in the effort to find Josh, and now in his support of his colleague.
We are working on a joint project.
He had passed a polygraph.
It's all in our perception, isn't it?
Priest and Wright went back a long way. It wouldn't have been a stretch to imagine them as partners in more than a school project. A pair of sharp, calculating minds. Wright, handsome and charming. Priest, socially awkward, with a crush on Hannah Garrison. Motive had been an elusive creature in this crime from the first. There had been no ransom demand. No one seemed to have it in for Hannah or Paul. The taunting, the planted evidence, suggested it was all about superiority, a game of wits. But taking Josh Kirkwood had also given Christopher Priest a chance to be close to Hannah, a chance to offer his help, to call attention to himself. And damned if it wouldn't sell books, he thought. The twisted tale of the psychopathic professors, brilliant minds fatally flawed. But had Priest had opportunity to take Dustin Holloman, to plant those clues? It seemed unlikely he would take that kind of chance, knowing the police had their eyes on him, and then there was Todd Childs to consider. He turned down another hall. He could take a look at Wright's office as long as he was here, see if it offered any insights. The cops would already have taken the place apart, hunting for evidence, but it was still important for him to have a sense of the places the people he wrote about inhabited. To be able to describe Garrett Wright's perfectly normal office would add to the unsettling idea that anyone could be warped beneath their ordinary facades. That kind of chill brought readers back again and again, like Romans to the Colosseum. The door to Wright's office stood slightly ajar. Jay brought himself up short at the sight. His escapade at the pack rat was still fresh in his mind, in the form of a dull headache that had nagged him since the accident. He moved cautiously along the wall, determined not to be taken by surprise this time. Sidling up to the door, he gently eased it open another fraction of an inch, expecting to see Todd Childs. The room was awash in paper. Books had been torn from their shelves and left on the floor. The place looked as if it had been tossed by goons. And in the middle of the mess stood Karen Wright. She looked utterly lost, fragile, overwhelmed by the state of the place. And he would take advantage of that, bastard that he was. Not giving himself time to turn noble, Jay rapped his knuckles twice on the doorframe and let himself into the office.
"Mrs. Wright?"
She jerked around and looked up at him.
I can't find anything, she said meekly.
"Well, ma'am, it is a hell of a mess," he said. "What is it you're looking for?"
"Books. Garrett asked me to pick up some of his books. He'll be angry about this. He likes his office neat and orderly."
"Do you have any idea who did this?"
"The police. They said they were looking for evidence."
Looking for evidence, and taking a little revenge, Jay reasoned. Garrett Wright stood accused of attacking and savagely beating one of their own. Cops didn't take a thing like that lightly.
You should have seen our house when they finished,
she murmured, as she began to set her husband's desk to rights.
They even took up floorboards, all for nothing. I told them they wouldn't find anything, but they wouldn't listen to me.
They're stubborn that way. She picked up a coffee mug that had been knocked to the floor and held it to her chest like a treasured doll.
You're that writer, aren't you? Garrett told me you're going to do a book about the case. He shouldn't be going to court. It's all a big mistake.
Is it? Jay asked quietly, watching her carefully.
He wouldn't take Josh.
Her gaze was like a butterfly, lighting and flying away from point to point, all around the room. She might have been lying, or she might have been afraid, or she might have been as cracked as Grandma's china, as Teresa McGuire, the victim witness coordinator, had suggested to him over coffee and cinnamon rolls at the Scandia house.
Garrett wouldn't have, Karen said, shaking her head. No, he wouldn't have. He wouldn't do that to me.
Wouldn't do what? He asked, trying to keep her attention focused on him.
He doesn't like children, she mumbled. He didn't like being a child.
Did you know him as a child? A thin smile trembled across her mouth, and she wandered off toward one of the gutted bookcases. Jay moved with her, to keep her face in view. I heard you helped out at the Kirkwoods while Josh was missing. You helped take care of the baby. Karen might have been Wright's spy, willing or unwitting, filling him in firsthand about the havoc he was wreaking on the lives of Hannah and Paul.
Lily, Karen said.
This time the smile was fuller, richer.
She's so precious. I'd give anything for a little sweetheart like her.
You don't have any children of your own? The smile fell.
Garrett and I can't have children.
I'm sorry, he said automatically. That was good of you to help the Kirkwoods. Was that your idea?
Oh, I didn't mind at all. Hannah and Paul are friends.
She used the present tense, as if it were still true, as if she had no grasp of the magnitude of the charges against her husband, as if by saying it was all a mistake, everyone would accept her word, and they would all continue their lives as if nothing had happened. She set the coffee mug aside, picked several books up off the floor, and slid them into place in the bookcase.
Garrett doesn't like messes, she said,
with an odd light of amusement in her eyes. Well, he seems to have got himself smack in the middle of a big one. Karen Wright shook her head.
Oh, no, she said. It's all just a big mistake.
Chapter 29 Barred from the room, Mitch exploded. Bullshit! Cameron winced. Phoebe cowered. Ellen looked him in the eye. Were you present in the room when she filled out her statement? He raked a hand back through his hair, as if trying to scratch loose a memory. Not right away. Stovich was bending my ear for a couple of minutes. When I did step into the room, no one said a goddamn thing to me. Everything was fine. If someone had tried to stop Dennis from going in, he would have squealed like a stuck pig.
That's what I said, Ellen complained, and Grabko should know it too. Costello has him dazzled.
I've never seen so much preening and posturing in my life. While you were at the autopsy, Grabko was calling your officers in this afternoon to get their take on it, but my gut tells me we've already lost the round.
Fuck me, Mitch grumbled. After all the trouble we went to, putting that lineup together, Jesus Christ.
He pulled in a deep breath and huffed it out. How bad does this hurt us? Ellen considered for a moment, turning her pencil over and over in her hands. For a hearing in front of a judge, not a lot. But I wanted Ruth Cooper on the stand in front of a jury, she admitted. Costello would have taken apart the lineup ID because Wright was too bundled up for a dead-on no-doubt, that's him. But her testimony combined with the voice ID would have made an impact.
Can you salvage anything?
She can testify that she saw a man on Ryan's Bay that morning, that he came to her house, that he spoke to her. Then Costello is going to get up on cross and ask her if that man is in the courtroom, if she can point him out to us, and she's going to have to say no.
Shit. They sat in silence for a moment, mourning the loss of their witness.
So, Ellen said, regrouping, what's the word from the ME?
Preliminary results of the autopsy show nothing to indicate murder, Mitch said. Unless something strange turns up in the lab, he's going to sign it off as suicide.
In her heart, Ellen knew Dennis Enberg had been murdered. The shadowed voice that had haunted her since that night whispered in the back of her mind.
The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers.
He had a blood alcohol level of 0.30, so he was good and drunk.
Too drunk to rig up the gun? She asked.
There are too many factors we don't know. He could have tricked out the gun when he was at 0.10, then drunk some more to get up his nerve. Or he could have been passed out and been fed that gun by a killer. The killer could have bashed his head in and then pulled the trigger to make it look like suicide.
Any opinions from the BCA? Cameron asked.
I haven't heard from them directly. Wilhelm and Steiger are off chasing a lead on the Holloman kidnapping. The mother got a phone call, allegedly from the boy.
A chill crawled down Ellen's spine. Just like what happened with Josh.
Apparently so. They traced the call to Rochester. They're down there now, checking it out. I don't expect them back tonight.
The inconvenience was too timely. Ellen had asked the three principal law enforcement officers to meet to go over everything they had one last time before the hearing. She wanted to have the clearest possible picture as to the status of the case, the most up-to-the-minute information from the BCA on the analysis of the evidence. With Wilhelm gone, she would have to track down the information by phone. A time-consuming process, and the clock was ticking. 4:40. Not for the first time, she felt as if their nemesis had a bird's-eye view of everything going on their side of the case. He had been three steps ahead of them all the way, playing with them like a cat with a mouse.
We can't lose, Wright had told Megan. You can't defeat us. We're very good at this game. Brilliant and invincible.
What if they were?
The report on the fingerprints in Enberg's office is about what you'd expect, Mitch went on. The place was a mess. There were prints everywhere. God only knows the last time he cleaned the place.
Prints on the gun?
Denny's only.
What about the time of death? Cameron asked.
The ME put it around 1 a.m., give or take an hour.
My mystery call came at 2, Ellen murmured. And the help at the donut hut put Paul Kirkwood at Enberg's office around 9:30, Cameron said. That rules him out.
Unless he came back later, Ellen offered.
Mitch shook his head.
I don't figure Paul for this. What's his motive? Enberg was no longer representing Wright, and he was doing a half-assed job before he got canned. Why should Paul off him?
Why should Paul go to see him? Ellen asked. It makes sense if Paul was Wright's accomplice, Cameron suggested.
We've had this conversation before, Mitch said. It's too bizarre for words.
Well, Costello would buy half of it.
Ellen tossed her pencil down. He's already tipped his hand. He's going to do his best to divert attention to Paul. Grabko ruled against him on the medical records, but that isn't stopping him from making his case to the press.
Asshole lawyers, Mitch muttered.
He caught himself too late and gave Ellen a look. Present company excluded. She shrugged it off.
What about the sci-fi cowboys? Has anyone confirmed their whereabouts on the night Dennis died?
All present and accounted for, provided you can believe the people who gave them alibis. They were in Deer Lake as a group on Tuesday to meet with Priest and returned to the cities that evening. They didn't come back until Thursday afternoon.
Any holes in their stories for Saturday night? Cameron asked.
Mitch shook his head. Not yet. I'd bet my pension Tyrell Mann torched that Cadillac, but I don't have a witness, and I don't have any evidence. In other words, at the moment we don't have shit. It's as simple as that.
Ellen pulled her glasses off and rubbed her hands over her face. Nothing is simple where this case is concerned.
That's old news, Counselor, Mitch said. If anything new comes in, I'll call. I'll be at home if you need me. Jesse's making dinner for Megan, and I get to help. A spark of happiness lit his bloodshot eyes. I'd better stop for antacid on the way. Kindergartners aren't known for their culinary talents. Ellen followed him to the conference room door. In the outer office, Quentin was regaling someone with his harrowing tale of being accosted outside family court. "And just as security arrived," he said, gesturing like a maestro, "the guy steps back and says, 'Hey, man, you're not who I thought. Sorry.'" Ellen pulled her attention back to Mitch. "How's Megan doing?" "Chomping at the bit to testify. She doesn't like being on the sidelines, you know. She's a cop, right down to her toenails." A shadow of doubt crossed his face as he weighed the wisdom of telling her something. Then he set his jaw in a stubborn line and plunged in. "I dumped Wright's background stuff on her to sort through." "Mitch!" "I don't want to hear it, Ellen. We're just too short-handed with everything that's been going on, and she's too damn sharp to waste," he argued. "I'll keep the paper trail clean." His expression softened. "She needs it, Ellen. She needs to know she can still do the job." "Fine." Ellen surrendered, too tired to fight, and too concerned for Megan's well-being. It wasn't as if Megan were being given access to physical evidence. The information she would be looking over was cut and dried, facts that were years in the past. Anything she might find had already become a part of history and couldn't be tampered with. God knew they needed all the help they could get. "Quentin's still reliving his narrow brush with excitement," she announced back in the conference room. "Polishing up the performance for his paramour," Cameron suggested with a smirk. "By the time he tells Jan, he'll have it sounding like a fight scene from Die Hard." "Our comic relief," Ellen said, settling back into her chair. Phoebe fluffed herself up like a little quail, tilting her chin to a proud angle. "Well, I think it was really gallant and original of Adam, the way he helped you." Cameron pulled a face of mock horror. "Adam?" Ellen frowned at her secretary. "There was nothing noble about it. It was a business deal, and he enjoyed himself. He got to be annoying and got rewarded for it. And what's with the first name basis?" "Nothing." Phoebe's gaze landed everywhere but Ellen's face. "That's his name, that's all. What am I supposed to call him?" "A distant memory," Ellen suggested sharply. "We've talked about this, Phoebe. He's a reporter. Being cute doesn't cancel that out."
"You don't know him," Phoebe said stiffly.
"Neither do you."
"I'd never get to know anyone if I was as paranoid as you are. Just because you never trust anyone doesn't mean people aren't trustworthy."
"That's an admirable attitude," Ellen said impatiently. "But you know something, Phoebe? This isn't Mr. Rogers' neighborhood. This is a big case full of bad people, out to get what they can and to hell with everyone else. So maybe you could do us a favor and grow up. You can make nice with anyone you want after it's over." Phoebe stood abruptly and gathered up her notebook and a messy stack of files.
"If you're through lecturing me, I'll go make those phone calls to the BCA now."
Ellen pulled a typed list of names and numbers from one of the files and held it out. "After you call the BCA, please call these probation officers and see if they've got anything for me."
"You're so insensitive," Phoebe charged.
Dumping the files onto the table, she ran out of the room.
"I'm guessing it was something you said," Cameron offered with a pained look. "Are you going after her?"
"No, damn it. I'm not her mother. I'm her bitch queen boss," Ellen muttered glumly. She had more important things to expend her energy on than her secretary's love life. What difference did it really make anyway? Slater's paper didn't mean anything to anyone who didn't live in Grand Forks. She put her head in her hands and groaned. Why didn't God make all secretaries postmenopausal? "Because then male bosses would never get any exercise chasing them around their desks?" Cameron offered. A weak chuckle rippled out of her. Sobering, she raised her head and looked at her bright-eyed young associate. "I've got a bad feeling, Cameron," she confessed. "The day before the hearing, and our boy pulls a stunt like that to call Dustin Holloman's mother. What do you think he might have in store for the main event?"
"I don't know,"
he admitted quietly.
Ellen stared out the window at the ominous gray of the sky and felt foreboding thicken the air around her.
I don't want to know.
The old habits came back, like ghosts, unwanted, unwelcome, bringing with them an uneasy sense of déjà vu. In her days on the fast track, the night before a major court appearance became a time of ritual, almost superstition. Too wired to relax, too afraid there was something she had overlooked in her preparation, Ellen would spend the evening in her office poring over and over the evidence, the questions she wanted answered, the strategy she intended to employ against her opponent. In the 2 years since she had come to Deer Lake, there had been no nights like that. Until this one. In the usual course of Park County events, an omnibus hearing would last 20 minutes, and there would be half a dozen scheduled for a morning, most of which would never take place because the defendant would plead out. Garrett Wright's hearing would be a whole different kind of circus, because of the charges, because of the defendant, because of Costello. This would be a mini-trial, complete with all the drama. She shooed Cameron out the door at 8:30, but flatly refused to go with him. She both needed and hated the need to fall back into the old rhythms. She both recognized and resented the edgy restlessness that hummed through her like an electric current. It pushed her out of her chair and walked her up and down the length of the conference table where she had spread out every document, every note they had. The heat in the building had been turned down into the refrigeration zone again. The county commissioners unwilling to bend the utility budget for the comfort of one attorney. She paced with her coat on, vaguely amazed that she couldn't see her breath. They had enough. Megan's and Mitch's statements alone should have been enough to get Wright bound over for trial. In addition, they would have the testimony of the BCA criminalist as to the preliminary findings on the ski mask that had yielded Wright's hair, and the sheet Wright had wrapped around Megan, the sheet that had yielded strands of Josh's hair and more of Wright's hair, and bloodstains that were consistent with Josh Kirkwood's blood type. It should have all made for a prosecution slam dunk. But still the doubts crept in, eroded her confidence, choked her. Old, familiar feelings. As Mitch had predicted, Wilhelm had not yet returned from Rochester. The call to Dustin Holloman's mother had been traced to a payphone in a mall, where there had to have been a number of witnesses. The BCA and local cops had spent hours canvassing the stores and hallways, showing Dustin's photograph, asking people if they'd seen anyone suspicious using the phones, asking if they might have seen anyone using a small tape recorder at the phones. It would have been lunacy for the kidnapper to drag the boy himself into such a public place. Every newspaper and television station in the state had been flashing Dustin's picture since the night of his disappearance. Most likely, the kidnapper had recorded Dustin's message and played the tape over the phone. Still, a risky proposition, Ellen thought, as she made another slow circuit around the table. Brazen. Bold. He was feeling cocky. Invincible. He had taken a careless chance just for the purpose of tying up the BCA. Or, perhaps, what he wanted was the public acknowledgement of his brilliance. But all it would take was one witness, one bored store clerk, one man sitting on a bench waiting for his wife, one teenager impatient to use the same phone, and they would have a description. The prospect brought a small adrenaline rush, another old, familiar feeling. There had always been a high associated with cracking a big case, a tense excitement in watching the cops close in, knowing that the next part was her part. It stirred within her now at the thought of Wilhelm bringing back a description, an artist's sketch, a videotape from a security camera. Who would they see? Todd Childs? Or someone they had never seen before? Adam Slater's question about the sci-fi cowboys came back to her as she stopped along the section of table where their file was laid out. None of the boys had been considered suspects in the kidnapping, but she now had first-hand knowledge of the lengths to which they would go to support their mentor. If they would commit vandalism, if they would commit arson, what else might they do? She had a good idea from their rap sheets. They had committed robbery, car theft, assault, drug deals, attempted rape. Would it be a stretch to include kidnapping? Theoretically, perhaps not. Logistically, It wasn't realistic. The cowboys were minors, living with parents, with guardians. They attended school, answered to probation officers. Slipping out of a dorm to set a car on fire was one thing. Being able to commit to the kind of complicated scenario these kidnappings had followed would require total freedom of movement. Nor was it realistic to think Garrett Wright would put his trust and his future in the hands of someone so young. Childs was a better bet. Childs, the psych major fascinated with the human mind. Learning and perception was Wright's specialty. What had they done to Josh's mind? What had they planted in his young mind to make him close himself off so completely? As her own mind pondered the questions, Ellen paged slowly through the materials they had gathered on the cowboys. The list of past members, the photocopies of old newspaper articles. One prominent headline announced the admittance of one of the first cowboys into the University of Minnesota Medical School. Another had won a scholarship to MIT. Success story after success story. She went down the list of names, many of which had been checked off or had notations beside them regarding the person's whereabouts. According to Wilhelm, the people he'd had checking into the past cowboys were turning up nothing but young men who had become productive members of society, and thanked Garrett Wright and his colleagues for it. Car thieves, vandals, burglars, gangbangers, all of whom Garrett Wright had helped turn around. Had any one of them ever seen Wright's other side? Had they ever looked into his eyes and had a moment of terrible revelation? Would they tell anyone if they had? So far, the answer to that question was no. Her gaze settled on an article she had reviewed before. The photo showed Christopher Priest and one of the boys in the foreground, the one who had gone on to MIT, working with a robot. Garrett Wright, with boys named James Johnston and Eric Evans, stood in the background. The article was dated May 17, 1990, the second year of the cowboy's existence. The murkiness of the copy gave Wright a sinister look. Or perhaps it was that he hadn't realized the camera would catch him in its frame, and he had been showing his true face, the one that hid beneath the handsome mask. The idea sent a finger of unease down Ellen's spine. Public sentiment was running higher and higher in Wright's favor. With every new exploit of Dustin Holloman's kidnapper, the public grew less patient with the prosecution, or persecution, as some saw it, of Garrett Wright, their local hero, their respected teacher. "I'm beginning to feel like the only person in the movie who knows the charming Count is a vampire," she muttered. Pulling the telephone toward her with one hand, she reached for the list of probation officers Phoebe hadn't called. She made contact with two, both of whom had burned out and left the job within the last year, and scratched the names of two former cowboys off her list of possible character assassins. Montel Jones, sci-fi cowboy-turned-engineering student at the University of Minnesota, had died in a plane crash in 1993. James Johnston had breezed through his undergraduate work in 3 years and was currently going for his master's in counseling. His former probation officer told Ellen that Garrett Wright's program was the reason. Daryl Munson, probation officer to two of the original cowboys, had left not only the profession, but the state, moving to Florida to run a diving school. His answering machine picked up with steel drum music. Ellen left a message and hung up, feeling no sense of accomplishment at all. But then, what had she really expected? That one of Wright's former charges would suddenly blurt out a tale of bizarre abuse after all this time? Contacting the past cowboys had never been more than an exercise in grasping at straws. A knock on the outer office door broke into her concentration. It might have been Wilhelm coming with news, or Deputy Quayle, her guard for the evening, or Cameron coming back because he'd had a brainstorm. Brooks stood in the hall, holding a picnic basket. "Why am I not surprised?" Ellen muttered. "Why would I actually believe you would stay away merely because I asked you to?" "Can I assume that's a rhetorical question?" he asked, eyes sparkling with mischief. "How did you get into the building?" she asked irritably. "How did you get past the guard?" "I bribed him with a chocolate cupcake
and an autographed copy of Justice for None. Good thing I'm not a psycho killer, huh?
He stepped past her and set the picnic basket down on the receptionist's counter.
I told him you and I were old friends from law school, and I wanted to make sure you got supper, knowing how nervous you are the night before a big case and all.
He's supposed to call up.
I told him it was a surprise. Gave him a little wink, a little nudge. He's a nice fella, Ed. A little too nice.
He turned serious.
He didn't check the basket. He didn't frisk me. He figured he knew me, which of course he doesn't. So I must be all right.
I don't know you either, she said quietly. Should I be in fear of my life?
He took in the sight of her standing there, swallowed up by her winter coat, her hair back in a haphazard knot that allowed thick strands to escape. Her eyes were bloodshot, the circles beneath them growing darker and deeper every day. This case was dragging on her, but she withstood it because it was her duty. He could have kicked himself for ever insinuating she was a coward, that she had been running away when she'd left Hennepin County.
Actually, I think you know me pretty well, he admitted. You sure as hell hit some nails on the head last night. I admit I'm a son of a bitch, but I'm contrite about it. Doesn't that just make you want to marry me?
Is that what you came here for?
No, he murmured. I wanted to make sure you got supper, knowing how nervous you must be the night before a big case and all.
The admission was earnest, the apology sincere. Ellen's wariness melted.
I'm surprised you wanted to bother, she said.
Why?
He asked, moving closer with just a shift of his weight. He caught a strand of her hair over his fingers and brushed it back behind her ear, his fingertips skimming the soft skin there.
Because I didn't get what I wanted last night? I don't give up that easily.
I'm not sure if that's good news or bad news.
Then maybe I should sweeten the deal. It comes complete with cupcakes, fried chicken, and information.
Information?
Supper? It's a package deal, counselor. You gotta eat the chicken to get the scoop.
Ellen's stomach made the decision for her. The egg salad sandwich she'd pulled out of the vending machine in the cafeteria for supper had ended up in the trash, and lunch had been a hastily grabbed cup of peach yogurt hours before. The aromas escaping the basket were too much for her. She led the way to her office, taking her place behind her desk. They spread the containers of food out on the blotter. Crispy fried chicken, coleslaw, French fries, buttery biscuits, the promised cupcakes.
Are you sure you're not trying to kill me? She said. This looks like death by cholesterol.
It's my southern fried lawyer, night before a big case special. I'm from Alabama, you know. We have a strong belief in the powers of grease. Chow down.
Ellen stabbed her plastic fork into a chicken breast and tore a succulent piece of white meat free. So what's this hot information?
I heard about the phone call to Dustin Holloman's mother, Jay said, wandering to the bookcase to peruse the compact discs. I heard it came this afternoon around 4:15.
Yes, the BCA guys traced it to Rochester. Frankly, I'm surprised you didn't beat it down there with a thundering herd.
It's another snipe hunt.
Another chapter. The pathetic desperation of the futile search. He ignored the jibe.
I was over at Harris College having a little chat with Professor Priest at about 2:30. He hustled me out, told me he had a class to prepare for.
He is a teacher. He selected a Philip Auberg CD and loaded it into the player. New Age piano music with a subtle Western edge drifted from the small speakers.
So, according to the main office, he didn't have another class until 7 tonight. Now, maybe he just doesn't appreciate my unique brand of southern charm. But that doesn't explain why he was driving out the campus gates when I was coming out of Cray Hall at 2:50.
Why were you leaving the building after him if he threw you out of his office?
I made a detour past Garrett Wright's office, where the lovely but loony Mrs. Wright
was trying to find some books her husband had asked her to stop for. Ellen stilled. What books? She didn't say, but I can't imagine there was anything left that might have been incriminating in any way. The cops had tossed that place like a Caesar salad. What did she have to say? That her husband shouldn't be on trial, that this is all a big mistake. She said Garrett wouldn't steal a child because he didn't like children, that he hadn't liked being a child. I asked her if she had known him as a child, but she didn't answer me that either. That little gal is one blade shy of a sharp edge, if you ask me. Her appetite suddenly on hold, Ellen sat back in her chair. According to what we know, Karen and Wright met in college. So he told her he had a rotten childhood. Confession is part of courtship, isn't it? I wonder what else he might have confessed to her. You'll never know, Counselor. A wife can't be compelled to testify against her husband. No. She's on Costello's list to testify on behalf of Wright. Of course, she's hardly a credible witness. Not that that will stop Tony from trying to get some mileage out of her, she grumbled. So you're leaving Cray Hall, and you see Priest driving away. He could have gone anywhere. He could have gone to the dry cleaners. He could have gone home. But he didn't. You followed him? All the way to the interstate. He turned south. Toward Rochester, an hour away. Ellen felt her pulse pick up a beat. If Priest was Wright's accomplice, would he have been so reckless as to leave an interview with a prominent crime writer in order to drive to the site of the next move in his sick game? Did he feel that invulnerable? Something else funny about my little visit, he said. I talked to a professor at Penn State who used to know Priest and Wright, who told me they were all kids in good old Mishawaka. They were different ages, from different parts of town. He didn't know either of them back then, but he thought it was quite a remarkable coincidence that they had all ended up at Penn State. When I mentioned it to Priest, he flat out denied it, said he grew up in Chicago. Why would he lie about that? It's easy enough to check out through school records. I don't know. Anyway, when I heard about the call to Mrs. Holloman, he went on, I got hold of Agent Wilhelm and told him. I figured you'd want to know too, and I wasn't going to count on his getting back to you tonight. Yeah? So what's in it for you? She asked, her gaze sharp on him. Nothing. Ellen gave him a speculative look as she raised her fork. You're turning into a regular good guy, Brooks. You'd better look out. You'll ruin your reputation. She had said it before, Ellen thought, that for someone who claimed to be a mere observer, he had a hard time grasping the concept. More often than not, his involvement had struck her as being self-serving. But what she saw in his face now, in the amber glow of her desk lamp, looked an awful lot like honesty. As if he cared. And it hurt him to care. He had come to Deer Lake to lose himself in someone else's misery, he had said. But the misery of Dustin's parents and Josh's parents was too close a cousin to his own. He had a son, had lost that son before he'd even known the child existed, had found him and had him taken away again all in the space of a day. Ellen could feel the tug to reach out to him. She reached for the telephone instead and punched in Mitch's home number. His machine picked up, but he answered himself as soon as Ellen began to leave her message. She told him everything Brooks had told her, and added a couple of her own hunches, all to be relayed to Megan. Diversionary tactics aside, the case was revolving around Wright and his circle of acquaintances, revolving in what seemed to be a spiral into the past. He had done this before. They had done this before. Christopher Priest had been heading south at 3 o'clock. The call had come a little past 4 o'clock. If Megan could dig up just one key piece. I thought O'Malley was off the case, Jay said carefully, as Ellen hung up the receiver. Regarding him with a poker face, she said nothing for a moment that stretched into another. You wanted me to trust you, she said at last. I'm trusting you with this. Agent O'Malley is digging into Wright's background because Wilhelm wasn't getting the job done. Jay gave a low whistle.
She's a little biased, don't you think?
I think she's a damn good cop, and there's nothing she can do to change Garrett Wright's past. Anything she comes up with will be established, corroborated fact.
Still, if Costello catches wind of this,
I'll know where he got it, won't I?
And you'll cut out my black heart with a grapefruit knife.
Worse, I'll let you answer to O'Malley. She won't bother with a knife.
Unfamiliar pleasure coursed through Jay. It was about trust, something Ellen had no reason to offer freely, and every reason not to offer at all. He rose from his chair and rounded her desk to kneel down beside her. Taking her hand, he raised it to his mouth.
"My lips are sealed," he said,
each word a caress against her fingertips.
She tried to draw her hand away, but he held it firm and drew the end of her middle finger between his lips. Her breath shuddered at the subtle abrasion of his teeth along the pad of her fingertip, at the touch of his tongue, at the gentle sucking.
"Jay..."
He drew his lips down her palm, lingered at the delicate skin inside her wrist.
"You trust me, Ellen?"
he whispered, drawing her up from her chair. Apprehension and desire shivered inside her.
"There's so much at stake here, Jay."
"I know," he said,
knowing she meant the case, knowing there was more.
"I've never been anyone's hero, Ellen," he said. "I've lived my life for myself, and to hell with everyone else. I've never had any trouble justifying or rationalizing or outright lying when it suited my cause. And I look at you and I think, Brooks, you got no business touching her, 'cause she's better than you'll ever be. But I want you anyway."
"And you always get what you want?"
"I used to think so," he murmured. "Now I stand back and look at what I've got, and none of it means a damn thing to me. The money, the house, the spite I prized so dearly. I look at Hannah Garrison, see her fighting for her child. I look at you, see you fighting for justice. What have I ever fought for besides my own gain? What good have I ever been to anybody?"
He forced a smile that was sad and wry.
"Looks like you might redeem me after all."
"No," Ellen whispered. "I don't want that responsibility. That's your choice. It has to be what you want."
"What I want," he echoed,
pulling her closer.
"I want you."
He kissed her slowly, deeply, and Ellen thought she could taste his yearning and the confusion that shrouded it. She kissed him back, her own emotions kindred spirits of his. When he lifted his head a fraction, the need in his eyes took her breath away, the need to be touched by something good. As tempted as she was, Ellen knew she couldn't fight that battle for him. She had her own war to wage, her own enemies all around.
"I need to prepare for tomorrow," she murmured.
He kept his arms around her.
"You need a good night's sleep, preferably with me. You can prepare until your eyes bleed, but that won't make you any more ready. You can't give more than all you've got, Ellen. You've done the best you can."
Her best. Her best hadn't measured up so far. She closed her eyes and saw Garrett Wright smile, that knowing, omnipotent smile that made her think he already knew the outcome of his game.
"That's what scares me most," she confessed in a whisper. "What if my best isn't good enough?"
She moved away from him, feeling rumpled and wilted, trying in vain to smooth some of the wrinkles out of her blouse. Back in Hennepin County, she had kept a change of clothes in her office, but Hennepin County was miles away, literally and figuratively. She didn't have a change of clothes here. She didn't know that she had any of what she really needed. The sharp edge, the bright eye, the quick mind. She didn't know that she hadn't left it all in Minneapolis. Watching her struggle, Jay remembered the blind panic that struck in the 11th hour before a case went to court, the naked insecurities. He had never measured up to the standards of his family, and what if they were right? What if, behind all the bluff bravado, the swagger, the smile, there really was nothing of substance to call on when he needed it most? The anxiety was one of the many things about being a trial lawyer that he never missed. There was no panic associated with what he did now, dealing with cases after the fact. It was safer. It hurt less. Maybe you're the coward, Brooks. Ellen hadn't wanted this case, but she had accepted the challenge, not for personal gain or glory, but because she knew she was the county's best hope for justice.
Too good for you, Brooks.
He crossed the room to where she stood, staring out through the barely parted blinds. Slipping his arms around her from behind, he pressed a kiss to her hair and whispered,
"You'll win,"
as if his own conviction was enough to make it so. "I wish I could be sure of that," Ellen said. But the one thing she knew with any certainty was that in this game, where the stakes were so high, there was no such thing as a sure thing. And she had the sick feeling that the other team was playing with a stacked deck. At 11:10, she trudged up the stairs to the third-floor law library. She had the dubious services of Deputy Quayle for another 40 minutes, time enough to pull the books she needed, for all the good they would do her. If Grabko had already made up his mind about the lineup ID, he would have found precedent to back himself. Anal retentive bugger that he was, he would no doubt have scoured every obscure text of U.S. case law in existence to support his decision. Ellen had assigned Cameron the task of finding rulings to back their position. He had carted a stack of books home with him, but she wanted a solid familiarity with the cases cited in the general rule regarding violation of the right to counsel, and so she found herself in the darkened halls of the third floor. She had thought of bringing Quayle up with her, but had taken pity on him and his bum hockey knee. After Brooks had gone, she'd had her chat with Ed about security, and he had assured her he'd let no one else in. The third floor was vacant, the courtrooms and construction junk waiting out the night. Logical assurances warred with creepy sensations. Chiding herself for being skittish, Ellen let herself into the library and flipped on the lights. It was a room designed for function. Industrial-grade carpet, the color of pea soup. No-frills oak bookcases varnished dark with age. Mission-style library tables and straight chairs that had been in place long before the retro mission decorating craze. She prowled the stacks with purpose, pulling the books she needed and carrying them to a table. She had memorized the names of the cases, state and federal. United States versus Wade, Gilbert versus California, Minnesota, state versus Cobb, and state versus Guevara. She forced herself to look them up, to mark the pages. No sense getting all the way home, only to discover she'd pulled the wrong book. Be thorough. Stay focused. Fight the nerves. The first two cases were nearly 30 years old. State versus Cobb was dated 1979. Not that it mattered if the ruling applied. State versus Guevara was the most recent, 1993, and the most pertinent, if memory served. That had been a child abduction case as well, up in Dakota County, on the southeast side of the metro area. A witness had picked Guevara out of a lineup, but Guevara's attorney had gotten the lineup thrown out. Unease crawled along Ellen's nerves as she remembered the trial had ended in an acquittal. She was trying an entirely different case. The logical side of her brain argued. Guevara had been charged not only with kidnapping, but had been indicted by a grand jury on murder charges. The fact that the little girl had never been found had weighed more heavily with the jury than any other aspect of the case. But that lineup might have tipped the scales the other way. Ellen turned the pages, page after page of case law, stopping cold when she reached State versus Guevara. Someone had been here before her, and marked the page with a slip of white paper. She turned the book sideways, and heart pounding, read the message on the note. "It is a sin to believe evil of others, but it is seldom a mistake." The clock on Josh's nightstand ticked 1 minute past midnight. Hannah sat cross-legged on the sleeping bag she had spread out on the floor, across the room from Josh's bed. Anticipation wound like a watch spring inside her, tightening with every passing minute, building to she knew not what. A battle, she thought. A battle for her son. Not simply for justice, but for Josh himself. He had been taken from her. She had played the role of victim, but no more. The longer she thought about it, the more clearly she could see it. The challenge of something evil. The role she needed to play. The struggle in the courtroom would begin in a matter of hours. But the battle would go on beyond the courthouse, beyond the reach of Ellen North or Anthony Costello. She could see that now. Closing her eyes, she summoned the evil, a faceless entity. In her mind's eye, she could see herself standing on a dark plain, the sky low and leaden. She could see Josh standing off to one side, just beyond her reach, his face completely without emotion, sightless. And she could feel the evil, cold and heavy. "You can't have my son. I'll kill you if I have to."
"I've already taken him. He's already mine."
"I'll kill you."
She raised her hand, and a knife appeared in her grasp. She slashed downward through the oppressive air, slicing the blackness like a canvas that split open to reveal a wall of blood. The blood poured over her, knocking her off her feet, filling her mouth and nose, choking her, drowning her. She fought to come awake, but it dragged her down like an undertow. And then there was nothing. Josh dreamed of a sea of blood. He was floating on it, like floating on an air cushion in the lake. Safe, but not safe. Safe because the taker said so, and that scared him because he didn't want to trust the taker anymore. He could feel his mother pulling at him, her hands reaching up from the sea to grasp at him. He wanted to go with her, but he was afraid that if he did, the taker would drown them both. But if he stayed where he was, the taker would always be with him, and the taker scared him more and more. He could see the other goner, in his dream, being held above him by the taker's hands, the hands tightening and tightening. The boy opening his mouth to scream, but no sound coming out, his eyes going wider and wider with terror, a terror Josh could feel inside himself. He didn't like the feeling. It made him want to cry. It made him want to be sick. It made him want to turn to his mother, but she was beneath the blood sea. In a panic, he turned within himself, using the taker's trick to trick the taker. He opened the door inside his mind, went into the smallest, most secret room, and vowed not to come out ever again.
"It is a sin to believe evil of others, but it is seldom a mistake."
Ellen saw the note on the table before her, heard the message, an eerie whisper that seemed to surround her. She could feel his presence, feel his hands close around her throat.
"Evil."
The hands tightened. She lunged up out of the chair and across the tabletop, sending books tumbling into the blood that covered the floor. She landed in it herself, on her hands and knees, and slipped and slid as she struggled to stand. She couldn't breathe, could feel her windpipe collapsing in on itself. Fighting, she staggered up and twisted around. Garrett Wright sat in the chair she had vacated, smiling. The hands around her throat were invisible.
"The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers."
The line rang in her ears, louder and louder, until the words were indistinguishable. Gasping for air, she jerked upright in bed and stared at the phone on the nightstand. Fear rose in her throat until she thought she would gag on it, but she forced herself to reach out and pick up the receiver.
"Ellen North," she said,
her mouth as dry as cotton. The silence was a heartbeat, and then came the voice, gruff and unsteady.
"It's Steiger. We've found the Holloman boy. He's dead."
Journal entry, February 1st, 1994. "Our litany of sins is an old classic song.
We started young and have lasted long. Infused with new blood, our game will go on. Chapter 30.
Ms. North, how will this affect the charges against Garrett Wright?
Ms. North, are you ready to admit you're prosecuting the wrong man?
Ms. North, are you holding to your accomplice theory? Ms. North, is it true your lineup witness recanted her identification of Wright?
Ms. North, Ms. North, Ms.